Welcome to Booked, where two guys tell you about the books they're reading. I'm Olivia Snedden.
And I'm Rob Olson. The book we're going to be reviewing tonight is the latest Wheel of Meat selection called At the Water's Edge by Sarah Gruen. To my knowledge, I think it's the first female author we've read in 2015.
This is one sexist podcast.
Yeah. To be fair, though, not a lot of female authors asking us to read their stuff either. So.
Neither did Sarah Gruen.
That's true. So this is like a pro-feminism thing or something.
It is, but you know what? One of our favorite guests is Amanda Gowan, and I'm pretty sure she's a woman.
Yeah, we don't have empirical evidence, but All signs point to she's not a man.
This is very true. Rob, tell us a little bit about Sarah Gruen.
This is the bio that I'm assuming we pulled off of Amazon.
No, I got it from some other page, because on Amazon, it's a first-person bio.
Oh, that's lame.
And I didn't want you to have to read it in some chicky Canadian voice. She's Canadian.
All right. Regardless of where she's from, Sarah Gruen is the number one New York Times and USA Today bestselling author of... USA Today does...
Apparently, I was thinking the same thing. Maybe we should give their bestseller list. Wait a minute, hold on a second. If a book is a bestseller, wouldn't it be the same thing? I mean, don't they use some type of actual financial information for this?
Yeah.
It's starting to sound like we could have our own bestseller list where we just talk about shit, like how much money we spent on the Sarah Gruen book. She's the bestseller this week because we had to buy her book.
That's true. I don't know if we should get into that, these semantics. She is the number one, blah, 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 best-selling author of Water for Elephants, Ape House, Writing Lessons, and Flying Changes. Her work has been translated into 43 languages and has sold more than 10 million copies worldwide. Water for Elephants was adapted into a major motion picture starring Reese Witherspoon, Rob Pattinson, and Christopher Waltz in 2011. She lives in Western North Carolina with her husband and three sons, along with their dogs, cats, horses, birds, and the world's fussiest goat.
I'd like for you guys to know that what you're hearing is unedited of Rob reading that. And Rob edited on the fly after making a mistake. He actually, like, while he was reading, re-edited to make it sound right. That's pretty impressive.
Wait, what did I do?
So the actual bio says her works have been translated. And then says later, and have sold more than 10 million copies. Mm-hmm. So you said her work has been translated.
Oh.
But then you changed the have to has, like on the fly.
Excellent.
I'm very impressed by that.
I'm going to have to, I'm taking your word for it. When I'm back editing, I'm going to listen to that.
Yeah. So here is a brief synopsis. This is three goddamn paragraphs. A synopsis for this book.
Yeah, I was reading this and I was like, well, we don't have to talk about the story at all.
Yeah, this pretty much covers it. We'll just we'll do some quotes maybe and give it some stars and call it a day.
Perfect.
After disgracing themselves at a high society New Year's Eve party in Philadelphia in 1944, Madeline Hyde and her husband Ellis are cut off financially by his father, a former army colonel who is already ashamed of his son's inability to serve in the war. When Ellis and his best friend Hank decide that the only way to regain the colonel's favor is to succeed where the colonel very publicly failed, by hunting down the famous Loch Ness Monster. That is not a typo. The Loch Ness Monster. Maddie reluctantly follows them across the Atlantic, leaving her sheltered world behind. The trio find themselves in a remote village in the Scottish Highlands, where the locals have nothing but contempt for the privileged interlopers. Maddie is left on her own at an isolated inn, where food is rationed, fuel is scarce, and a knock from the postman can bring tragic news. Yet, she finds herself falling in love with the stark beauty and subtle magic of the Scottish countryside. Gradually, she comes to know the villagers, and the friendship she forms with two young women open her up to a larger world than she knew existed. Maddie begins to see that nothing is as it first appears. The values she holds dear prove unsustainable, and monsters lurk where they are least expected. As she embraces a fuller sense of who she might be, Maddie becomes aware not only of the dark forces around her, but of life's beauty and surprising possibilities. This is so like us to read a book like this. Like, we really need to branch out a little bit.
I was just thinking that that's pretty much the story, every story that we've read this year. Yeah. That Star Wars book, essentially, same thing.
There are dark forces in that, too. And there's the Force, and there was a chick. Wasn't her name Maddie? What the hell was her name?
I think the Loch Ness, I'm pretty sure the Loch Ness Monster was in it for sure.
There was a space version of it. The thing that jumped up out of the water that Luke had to
kill
with his lightsaber. Yeah.
Fuck, so. This is like exactly the same thing.
Pretty much.
Go back and listen to that review, and then you can come back and listen to like the fun stuff after the review.
Yep. All right, in case you're not going to go back and listen to that review, I guess we promised it. It is a Wheel of Meat selection, so we have to follow through on it. Here's what happens. The synopsis pretty much nails it. We're introduced to Maddie and Ellis, her husband, who are just party animals at a New Year's Eve party. They're drinking and carousing and doing all that stuff, hanging out with their buddy Hank, longtime friend of theirs. They're all really, really drunk, and we don't really see what the effects are of their drunkenness so much until the next day. So, you know, we kind of see them drunk and having a good time, and then the next day there's a hangover and some realizations are made about what transpired at said party.
Very true, and this is the kind of world that I could never live in, because the greatest repercussions seem to be social repercussions, if that makes any sense. So, like, you can be, I guess, within your own class. So this is very, a lot of the stuff that happens in this book is the whole book is from the perspective of someone who's like ridiculously rich and has nothing to worry about in life. So all of the ups and downs in life to the point where, you know, we meet up with these characters is just social pressure, status related things and things like that. So the worst thing that can happen to someone is, you know, they make a fool of themselves and then everybody is judging them for it. So that's kind of where we start out with this little bit of a disgrace. And then the next morning, there are some consequences, and there's Ellis gets in a fight with his father. And while this is not something that's unusual, this one kind of goes beyond the usual adversarial kind of interactions, because for kind of the first time ever, he brings up the fact that his father was accused of faking pictures of the Loch Ness Monster.
Just every time we say Loch Ness Monster, I'm just going to crack up. Yeah, many years ago, the colonel had evidence that he was able to bring forth that the Loch Ness Monster existed. And he was debunked and therefore disgraced. So, I mean, I'm guessing his family is still well-to-do and accepted in the social circle. So I'm guessing it kind of blew over after a while.
Right.
It's one of those things that people kind of sweep under the rug and don't talk about. But this takes a toll on the colonel. His son actually saying, you know what, you're the one that disgraced this family. It's not me and the drinking and whatever. You're the one that faked these pictures. So the colonel completely flies off the handle, throws Ellis and his wife, Maddie, out into the streets and cuts them off, allowance-wise, or whatever it is that rich people get.
So they're living in the gutter, begging food on the streets, right?
Right, yeah. They move into, like, a hotel of some sort.
Like a 5-star hotel, and he still has his allowance from his family. So they're, like, still rich as hell, but just not impossibly rich. They're just regular rich. And
I don't know if they were regular rich. It seemed like they were concerned about money. Like they had a little bit left from previous allowances, but
it was an ongoing allowance that hadn't been cut off yet. Or no, I mean, like, okay, so what? Some anyway, whatever it happens to be, details. But they're still like Dark Knight Rises. Did you see that movie, the Batman movie?
I did, yes.
When he loses all his money, but he still gets to keep the house, and what's-her-name says, you know, even the rich don't get poor the same way or something like that. I don't know. It would be a much better reference if I actually knew what she said.
Yes. But that's okay, because now they could embark on the plan that they actually had the night before, where, you know, when this plan is actually revealed to us, we don't know about the colonel. But that they're going to go to Scotland and actually prove the existence of the Loch Ness Monster. And that is going to, I don't know, in equal parts, this is where it's really weird. And maybe this is what real life is really like. It was like equal parts, this will show him, because I'll prove what he was unable to prove, but it would also like redeem the status of their family. So at the same time, it seemed like a double-edged sword.
Like a big fuck you, but also like a, hey, take me back because we're cool.
Right. And like, now I prove that, that, you know, that you weren't a faker, that this did exist, you know, kind of thing. So our trio, now this is all during World War II.
I was just about to say that.
Yeah. Very integral part to this story is that they get on a military ship of some sort, which seems like a terrible idea in a time of war, especially World War II, which was a lot of it was fought in the water.
Out of those U-boats.
Yeah. Yeah. So, to go to Scotland. This is all like, this is like chapter three stuff here. And we're just warming up.
So much happens in Scotland. So much of this book. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so the trip over essentially consists of lots of, seasickness for Maddie. And, so one of the things throughout the book, one of the things you see is as the characters, go through their experiences getting to Scotland and then looking for the Loch Ness Monster. there's a gradual change in the characters. In the synopsis, it said that Maddie kind of becomes friends with these people who run the hotel that they're staying at, hotel inn, whatever you want to call it. And Ellis and Hank are hopelessly lost in their world of privilege and status. And you can see in the beginning in the ship where those kind of attitudes and then things start to solidify or change into, you know, something else. Like Maddie goes one way and those guys kind of go the other way. And it's really comes to light when the Germans had torpedoed another ship or something. And the ship that Maddie and Ellis and Hank were on stopped to try and rescue some people. And Hank and Ellis just stay in their room so they don't have to see the suffering of the people, whereas Maddie sees it and is really affected by it. So that's kind of the start of these people kind of diverging from the path that they were on and like the privileged life they led to kind of going in different directions, at least emotionally, philosophically, stuff like that.
I said one of the issues I had with this book, so if that was a, okay, there are like 50 chapters in this book. I think 48 was the number of chapters. So these were mostly very, very short chapters. So there's an entire chapter spent on the boat trip. So we're talking like 5-6 pages, 8 pages. That includes like, we have a small cabin. I get seasick a lot. Oh, by the way, this book rivals Sarah Gruen, rivals Pablo de Stare in bodily fluids.
So much vomiting
this happening. This fucking Maddie, man, she couldn't do anything without vomiting. You know, oh, I'm vomiting, and oh my god, there's this thing, and we're bringing on sailors who are charred but still alive and just completely broken and injured, you know, beyond all repair and stuff. That's one chapter. Later, chapter like 35 is an entire chapter about them getting ready for like a little dance at the inn.
Yeah.
So, I was kind of like, it almost seemed like she glazed over. Like the real horror that happened was this early chapter 7 or whatever it is, and she gave it exactly as much attention as she did the Valentine's Day dance, the preparation for the Valentine's Day dance, I should say, at the end.
Can I pause you? And I just want to say that if we were to have blurbed this book, I think we couldn't have come up with a better blurb than Maddie. She can't do anything without vomiting.
Yeah, pretty much, man. Wow.
But yeah, that's a good point. The horrors of seeing these people, you know, these war ravaged people. There was probably more time spent learning what type of housework Maddie ends up doing around the inn later in the book than actually describing the scene of carnage at sea and how it affects the characters. So it was an interesting choice.
Mm-hmm. So Rob had mentioned work at the inn. So here's what happens. They go to this inn in this little small village that's right near Loch Ness, right? Is that, I mean, that's what it would be, right?
Okay. Yeah. It's the Loch.
Yes. Near the Loch. And you know, it has no electricity, but it's the only inn that's in that town that's close enough to, like, you know, daily travel to the Loch for them to do their monster hunting or whatever you want to call it. So you have these really wealthy people. They go to this little inn. There's no electricity. They're the only guests at the inn, and they're only taken in because Maddie is with them. The Angus, the owner of the inn, or the manager, I guess, of the inn, only takes them in on this like cold, rainy night when they get there because there's a woman. Because he's like, you two guys are idiots. I'm not taking you in. The inn is closed for business, whatever. But then he finds out that there's a woman and he just can't bring himself to not take them in. So he takes them in, and to make a long story short, Hank and Ellis, you know, they're drunk all the time. Ellis is kind of degenerating as a husband right before our eyes. And Maddie takes solace in these three people that work at the inn, Meg, Anna, and Angus, the innkeeper. And yeah, at some point she winds up doing it. There's like the montage scenes where she's doing like cleaning rooms and stuff. I could just hear like the music in the background and like the little cut scenes from like a bad 80s movie. Sorry, I watched Tough Turf earlier today.
Take it to the limit.
Yep.
Yeah, like that kind of thing.
So that kind of sums up that whole part, is she kind of is embraced by these people because she sees the value in what they do, and because, fuck it, let's face it, she's left alone by her husband and his best friend, so she has no choice, really, is what it is. She's bored. She does this out of boredom.
Yeah, she started out actually joining them on their expedition down to the lock to try and find the monster, but was consistently criticized for any of her efforts to help by pointing out things in the water and things like that, so she kind of just gave up, got fed up, and stopped going with them. And it's worked out for them too, because they just kind of pushed their drinking farther and farther. And Ellis was taking her Maddie had these pills, I don't know what they were, some sort of, I'm assuming, opiate kind of pill,
yeah,
that she had prescribed to her for kind of BS reasons. She had a freak out at one point, and they over whatever fucking she has pills, he keeps taking them without and she realizes at some point that like the pill, like the giant amount of pills that she had to last like their entire unknown stay in Scotland is dwindling quickly, because he's kind of a pill addict and an alcoholic, and he just becomes more abusive and just like a total asshole. And so she kind of retreats into her happiness of spending time with these inn people, who are very wholesome, family oriented, happy, normal people, basically the opposite of everything she's ever experienced in her privileged world.
The other character that bears mentioning, maybe two kind of characters, the war itself plays a really, really big part in this. So we're not seeing it from the front, but as mentioned in the synopsis, you know, at several points, the postman brings the news, you know, so-and-so, you know, your uncle's dead, that kind of thing. But it's really interesting, because they live in a place where at night you can't have any lights on, because you become a target for bombers. So there's a lot of kind of interesting stuff about the rules. So the rules are, you have a gas mask with you at all times when you're out and about, outside of your home or the inn in this case.
Doesn't everybody do that?
I was going to say, it started going in the bizarro realm a little bit, I think, and that kind of drew back. So I'm guessing this is all historically accurate, that this was probably a thing. But like the blackout shades that they had, like these wooden shades to black out all light, because if there's any light coming out from your home, you'd be fined. But more dangerously than the fine is you could be a target for bombers. So there's a couple of evacuations to a little, I don't know, bomb shelter shed kind of thing. So there's that. And
which the description of that thing was basically like, isn't it just kind of like a smaller house? Like,
that's what I thought. I thought like that's where they keep the lawnmower. Like,
right, exactly.
It's like, didn't seem. It's like, be careful. There's like three steps down. Like, what?
Just seemed like, yeah. And there was like little beds inside and everything. I'm like, and it wasn't like it was like a mile away from the building or anything. I guess if someone was going to bomb something, they would probably choose the larger building. But anybody who they're on that side of the war, so you would think, well, we've got this little shed where we hide when there's bombers, so let's get that fucking shed. That's what I'd be thinking.
Yeah. But then there's like superstition. I was going to say there's the Loch Ness monster, but there's some other superstitions that are pretty prevalent throughout. So there's a woman, this kind of old crony woman, that if you see her,
like she's not somebody, like she's someone's crony, but she's like an old crone.
Yes, exactly. Yes, crone like woman, who like if you see her, that means somebody's gonna die. There's teas to cure people, like kind of, you know, witch doctory kind of medicine. There was something else. There was something else that was real super.
The Loch Ness monster.
Yeah, there was the Loch Ness monster. Who I thought it was really interesting that they're there to find the Loch Ness monster, and that the three main Scottish characters that are in this. So the shopkeeper and the two ladies that work there. Mm-hmm. None of them ever address or offer an opinion as to if the Loch Ness monster is real or not.
That's a good point.
They live in the town.
They kind of tolerate, or they usually, it seems like they don't typically tolerate people who are hunting the monster.
Right, but it's, I just thought it was really interesting, that being the catalyst for the entire story, that you have, the outside of Maddie, the three people that have the most verbal input in this book, too. I mean, so almost most of the dialogue occurs between the four of them, Maddie and right. The three inns people, that it just never comes up, that none of them are ever like, you know, there's no such fucking thing, right? Or, like, don't worry, they'll find it, because everybody here has seen it. We know it's a thing. Like, just, it's never addressed by the people who work and live, you know, in that area, the inn people specifically.
Yeah. Here's a thought that I had too, and this may be intentional, just to kind of highlight the difference of perspective of someone who is born into ridiculous privilege and someone who actually has to have an actual normal life. I was surprised that the normal everyday Scottish people weren't like, "Don't you know there's a fucking war?" And you're like hunting a mythical beast. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, that's true. And I mean, you got a little bit of that before they left, but you're right. It wasn't really so much addressed on the other side.
Yeah. They were just like, well, we'll take their money.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right. Character wise, here's some other things that happened. Did you find this book to be very predictable?
Yeah.
Okay. So, Maddie, of course, as her relationship continues to fall apart with Ellis, you know, there's got to be a new love interest, right? And it's going to be basically the only other man in the book, Angus the innkeeper.
Who, by the way, and this is just, I could not help this, from the way he was described and everything, I just imagined Groundskeeper Willie from The Simpsons the whole time. No? Not you?
No. I mean, I'm pretty sure I know who you're talking about. I don't watch The Simpsons, but I have a vision of who I think that is from just having seen, you know, yeah, stuff about it.
The Scottish character. Yeah. Oh, and one more thing. I know I'm completely interrupting what you're saying, but I just finished my my thematic beer choice for this.
Oh, what are you drinking tonight, Rob?
So, God, that sounded so formal, like it's a segment. I'm drinking, I just finished a Three Floyds Brewery Robert the Bruce Scottish Style Ale.
And how is that? What does it taste like?
It tastes exactly like Scotland. A little bit kind of bland. I don't know anything about Scotland. I'm sure it's beautiful and awesome. It fine. I think it could stand to be barrel aged, but maybe add a little bit more flavor, a little kick to it. It was a little bit on the boring side. But I just cracked open a different beer, Bell's Saturn is what it's called. And this one is a barley wine aged in bourbon barrels. This is going to be good stuff.
What percentage of flavor, of bourbon flavor, do you think that adds to a beer? Like, if you were to drink that mm-hmm. versus drinking the same beer that was just aged in, I don't know, whatever, regular barrels, I guess, beer barrels. What percentage do you think that actually adds of, like, bourbon-y flavor?
The best way I could describe it is the flavor that you're getting is almost like if you just are drinking straight bourbon and you take a drink of it, you kind of have that after flavor, like when you breathe out. That's pretty much what the taste is that gets added to the beer. Does that make sense?
It does.
And that's Robert, not a percentage, sorry.
Rob and I discovered on our trip to Minneapolis that although I couldn't care less about beer or bourbon, that I'm fascinated by how some of this stuff is produced. So
it is interesting. We should brood, where that's going to be our
Third podcast.
Our third podcast, yeah.
Back to the story. sorry if we're spoiling this for anybody, but I do want to talk about one more kind of theme that was painfully clear from fairly early on in the book too. So the Angus thing, we kind of was going to have, we didn't mention it because there's a foreword at the beginning of the book that describes this terrible thing that happens. And, you know, man, after about the fourth page Angus was on, I was like, oh, I'll bet that this is what happened.
Yeah.
So it was pretty predictable for me. The other thing was I found it really interesting how they addressed. All right, so if you're planning on reading this, I'll give you 10 seconds to mute this out or to skip forward a little bit, because I kind of want to talk about this a little bit. It's interesting and timely in some way, shape, or form, I guess. I think I've given everyone enough time. So apparently, Ellis and Hank are a thing. They've got a thing for one another. And this is kind of, I thought, obvious from pretty early on that they're gay. But the way it was handled in this book, I have to imagine, is probably a little historically accurate, where it's never actually said that they're gay. It's implied and it's hinted at in fairly clever ways. And I was just thinking that this book was written, I'm assuming written a year ago, you know, before it went to press.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when we're addressing homosexuality and the ability for homosexuals to get married and to have relationships and to not be, you know, whatever, looked down upon by the rest of society. And this book kind of takes the angle of, you know, we're going to look at what this was like. Was that now 70-ish years ago? And I thought it was handled pretty well and interestingly without, because at no point did they ever actually come out and say that those two were gay or that there was, you know, anything really going on between them.
It never was like, and then they went to Mouthtown.
Is that a bar in your neighborhood?
I don't know. The bars change here all the time, so there could be a Mouthtown that I'm just not aware of yet.
Maybe we should open Mouthtown.
Welcome to Mouthtown. And which puts kind of a twist on it, because essentially Maddie kind of comes to realize in kind of the, as the distance between her and Ellis gets greater, and her closeness to people with real feelings gets better, that she never really was cared for by her husband. And it's a really sad moment. It's kind of an ongoing sad moment, just how terrible and pitiful her married life is. But it makes it so that you're thinking, these cruel people, like, Ellis only married her so that there would be no suspicion that, you know, something was wrong with him, you know? So it's messed up, but that's, I'm sure, how things happened back in the day.
Yep. So really, that's it. I'm sure from what we've told you, you can kind of figure out how this bad boy ends.
Ride the Loch Ness Monster up into the stars.
Dude. There's some scenes in there. There's that scene, right, where it's implied that it might have been the Loch Ness Monster that knocks Maddie on her ass.
Yep.
But then some other people take it to mean something completely different.
Right, and then, like, the next chapter seems to imply that those people were right.
Oh.
And then there's some sex.
Oh.
Because after you think the first thing, that it's kind of an aphrodisiac, right? Loch Ness Monster knocks you on your ass and you just, all you want to do is bone.
I'm thinking that, yeah, that I'm sure. I don't know what the right reaction is to getting knocked over by a Loch Ness Monster, so I guess any of them could be right. I'm going to talk about one more plot point without really, just in case anybody's planning on reading this. As in all great books, at the end we're faced with this challenge for the protagonists. I'll say plural at this point. Like, how are they going to get out of this? And then there's, like, this grand reveal that I thought was so just, I don't know, man. It really rubbed me the wrong way. Like, I was like, oh, of course that's what happened. Because, fuck, how else would you get out? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It was just way too convenient. It was a Sean Ferguson moment.
Here's what I'll say about that. There was, like, what Livius is talking to, there was kind of, like, a little bit of a puzzle, and there was just a few pieces to it. One of the pieces I think went in really well. Like, that piece, unless you thought it was predictable, Livius, I thought actually ended up being really well. And that was the resolution of the Angus trouble.
That's what I was saying. That's the one I thought was a little far-fetched.
All right. I liked that part. Okay. Now, the resolution of Maddie's problem, which is not too difficult to figure out, is her husband. Mm-hmm. How that issue resolves, I thought was like ridiculous.
Well, okay. All right. Let's just talk in plain words. He was killed by the fucking Loch Ness monster.
No, that doesn't even say that though.
No, but come on, man. That's what they're saying happened. Like, yeah, fucking Hank is like, when I saw him, he was angry, but like, he was fine. He was alive, and then he's like, fucking, like, just completely obliterated.
No, he had like, drowned, like, he had drowned in 2 inches of water.
Oh, that's what it was. Yeah, that's yeah. I was kind of like, well, yeah. How did you not think the fucking Loch after the Loch Ness monster knocks Maddie on her ass to get her to realize that it's okay for her to be with Angus,
to get her to fuck a Scotsman?
How is the Loch Ness monster not going to fix the gay husband problem? I'd have been mad at the Loch Ness monster if it didn't.
The Loch Ness monster is the most aggressive couples counselor of the 1940s Scotland. Oh, shit. I mean, I can't argue with that. Like, maybe the Loch Ness monster was like watching all along.
Well, that's what I was thinking, and it's kind of back to the point we're making. We'll agree to disagree on which part was most fabricated to fit the story. Yeah, that's kind of my thought, was that the Loch Ness monster was looking out for her, and when the fight starts, when the initial argument and stuff goes down, and they're by the water. I was actually expecting them all to see the Loch Ness monster come out and just chomp this guy to pieces. So it wasn't surprising that it was kind of, I thought, alluded to at the end when he drowned in 2 inches of water, that the Loch Ness monster did something to him and then dropped him back on the bank.
Gotcha. Yeah, I could see that. That's definitely within the realm of possibility. The way that it was left, it was very mysterious, just like the Loch Ness monster, although no mystery. The monster actually existed in the story.
Yep. All right, ready to wrap this bad boy. You have any quotes?
Do you? Because I do.
I actually do. I have a couple.
This my first quote was more just to kind of strike up a conversation with Levius about it. He leaned back and let the smoke drift from his mouth to his nose in a swirling white ribbon that he re-inhaled. He called this maneuver the Irish waterfall.
Yeah, I've always known it as the French inhale.
Okay. That's no, a real just, thing?
Yeah, oh, yeah, it's totally a thing, but I've always known it as the French inhale. You can picture it, right?
I know exactly, yeah. I've had enough smoker friends.
There you go. It is a thing.
Gotcha.
This isn't so much a quote as... I love this. This is pretty early on in the book. 12% and Maddie's kind of talking about some of the shenanigans that her and the boys would get up to. At one point she says, we pulled entirely harmless pranks, like hiding someone's yacht in the wrong slip or turning the racket club's pool water purple.
Yeah, if that's not an indication of the type of privilege we're talking about.
It's awesome stuff, man. Because, like, rich people, they have to operate on a different level than we do.
And you can imagine, like, you're walking down to your yacht one morning and you're like, what happened to my yacht? Oh, those crazy kids.
Yep, pretty much. That's exactly what I was picturing.
Like little Benny Hill music playing in the background.
Mm-hmm.
Again, more of a criticism than an actual quote. We'll get to actually good quotes because there is some well-written stuff in here. This is the dreaded dangling modifier. I don't know if you picked up on this, Livius. I realized I'd made it sound like it had spontaneously sprung a leak when in reality it had been torpedoed by a German U-boat with 1,100 civilians on board. And I read that as the German U-boat had 1,100 civilians on board.
Yep. I didn't catch it. When you were reading it just now, I was listening for it. And yeah, that's definitely how it could be taken.
But definitely it was the other boat that got bombed by the U-boat that was supposed to have the 1,100 civilians on board. Dangling modifier, whatever company published this book, get your editors on that shit. That's confusing.
Rob said he had good quotes, and I realize now that the five things I highlighted, one of them was for reading, Two of them are for reading, and the other three were more just points to be made, I guess. So I'm going to go ahead and go with my only other actual quote, which is Maddie blows up at her husband and finally accuses him of being gay. And this is how it was treated at the time. "Were you heads or tails?" I asked. "And more importantly, did you win or lose?"
That's good stuff. Powerful.
Yeah, I mean, really interesting. And I don't know if this was language of the times for that, but clever in some ways, I guess.
I liked this this quote. This was, I think, Maddie just making an observation about a person. "Although the men in his lineage had married exclusively beautiful women for generations, he was proof that such planning couldn't guarantee an outcome." That's good stuff. It's a way to call someone ugly.
Yep. Some of this reminded me of of what living in Romania in a small village might be like, based on my travels there, the most recent of which was 27, 28 years ago or so. Maddie is not doing so well, so this is the treatment. "They tucked stoneware pigs by my feet, and Mater, who is a person, after pressing her ear to my chest and shaking her head, disappeared for a while and returned with a steaming, smelly poultice that she shoved down the front of my nightgown. She put crushed garlic between all of my toes and wrapped my feet. When she replaced the quilt, she laid an extra one still folded across the bottom of the bed, weighing me down even further." So not only is there a poultice for curing Maddie's ailment, but the garlic, it actually keeps the vampires away.
Yikes. Do you, like, cringe when you read the word garlic?
A little bit.
I don't blame you. I've got a couple more. One's kind of lighthearted. I just liked the saying, and the other one's actually serious and one of the better quotes of the book. I'll do the lighthearted one first. Someone was offering to pour a drink for someone else, and this was their response. "Just a wee one. And you know what they say. Always carry a large flagon of whiskey in case of snake bite. And further, always carry a small snake." I like that a lot. I'd be getting lots of snake bites, is what I'm trying to say. just no response from Livius.
I understood.
And then this one, the overall thought is they're out there trying to hunt the Loch Ness Monster and all that stuff. And this is after Maddie had gone through lots of realizations about the reality of her husband and what type of person he is. "I stared at him for a long time. If he wanted to end his search for the beast, he need look no further than a mirror."
That actually was pretty good. I remember that one.
And it was cool because there was a quote earlier in the book that was kind of like, ooh, he's kind of a monstrous person. And then this kind of was the full kind of reveal. So it was almost like there was she had a reflective moment that was like, ooh, he could be a bad person. And then later on, this was like when she fully realized it.
Yep.
Wrap
that
up.
Ellis, he's something. Yes, please, let's wrap this bad boy up.
Wrap it.
All right, so this was a Wheel of Meat selection. Typically speaking, I mean, we kind of review books we want to read, which is, I don't want to say unfair, but people are like, oh, you guys don't hate everything. Well, you know, when you're picking the books you want to read, it's easy to not dislike them because you already kind of have a feel for what they're about. This is... Man, this is almost 50 Shades of Grey out of our realm of reviews, I would say, right? Like, this is about the farthest thing from what we would normally read.
Yeah, it's pretty far out there.
Our other two Wheel of Meat selections, you know, one was sci-fi, but Star Wars sci-fi, so light sci-fi at best. And the other one was it's a goddamn vampire book, and we should review more vampire books, so...
Vamped?
Yeah, this one, I didn't know what to really expect. So I think I went into it pretty clear-minded and not prejudiced against this book at all. So here's kind of a thumbs up, thumbs down for this book. Thumbs up. I like the historical aspect of it. I like when I could learn something while reading a story, and it was nice to see how people in a village in Scotland probably accurately lived during World War II. So some of that was pretty great. The rest of it was really kind of predictable, and here's rich people, and we're gonna present them with these financial challenges and put them in this kind of roughing it situation and see how they do. Well, you know, like I said, some of that was predictable. but probably pretty realistic. I think that relationships of that type, financially arranged type relationships like that, probably are not what we're accustomed to today. So I think that may have been also kind of historically accurate. So I liked some of that. Thumbs down, kind of what I just mentioned, the predictability. I kind of saw all of this coming, and it's not to say that we don't see that happening in other books where you just have a feel of where it's going to go, but I mean, it was predictable for me down to the Loch Ness Monster intervening in her relationship at the end. So there was that. I thought there were some kind of plot holes in the story, which I'm not going to dwell on now or really go into. But overall, this was much easier to read than I anticipated it would be. And by easy, I mean I read it probably in a good 4 sittings. So I was able to take it in good big chunks without being desperately bored. There are books I've liked much better that I put down after, you know, 15 or 20 minutes, you know, and had to step away from for a little bit. So that being said, I could review this as what it is, or I could review it on how I felt for it. So I'm going to choose to rate it on how I felt about it. I'm going to give it 3.5 stars.
All right. Yeah, I was kind of worried. I didn't know where you were going to go with that because it sounded like a bunch of bad stuff, but you ended up giving it not so bad a rating.
I really liked, like I said, the historical aspects of it and the stuff I felt was, I mean, the Loch Ness Monster stuff was, here's the problem. If we read a book, they were like, this is going to be about the Loch Ness Monster. I'd be like, all right, whatever. Loch Ness Monster gets involved. It talks. It asks for $3.50. Fine. This one was kind of like, we have a very realistic book, but then we have all this kind of voodoo Loch Ness Monster shit going on. So it's, I don't know.
All right. Here's what I thought. The label on the bottle is pretty nice. It's got the picture of Saturn. The beer
wrong,
itself
wrong,
is...
Wrong. Wait, whoa. What? Wrong. What? Wrong podcast. Oh. Wrong podcast. Ruddy.
Shit. Jesus
Christ.
It does have a good bourbon-y flavor. Okay.
Yeah, there's. Maybe we'll provide a link to that podcast if you want. That's what you want to listen to. There's guys doing that already.
Drunked?
Yeah, drunks.
Drunks. All right. Seriously, though, once I found out that this was the author of Water for Elephants that I had actually heard of and kind of knew the realm in which we were living, or reading, I guess, I pretty much knew what I was going to expect. It was going to be a serious story, which basically breaks down to this is a woman's... It's kind of an adult that's coming of age. This is the most blunt way I could put it. And it's someone who's kind of... The curtain of privilege is drawn from her eyes when she sees how the world really runs. And she grows because of it. And there is some turmoil that's involved and some ghosts and the Loch Ness Monster. And... that intervenes in her relationship. I think Livia said that greatly. I knew what to expect. It's a story about a woman's personal growth. It's a story about her discovery of what love really is. And it's a story about the Loch Ness Monster being a couples counselor. So because I pretty much knew going into it how this would go, I knew what I was getting into. The story actually is, I mean, she's a good writer. She writes a good story. And she wove those elements that I described into a fairly consistently interesting story. So I actually liked it pretty well. Definitely not the typical story I would read, but, you know, I will say that I'm glad I did. And I will say by far, without question, without doubt, the best Wheel of Meat that we've had so far. and so I'm going to take credit for this one because... I'm the one that told Livius to flip it around and do it backwards. So I think that I had a little bit of a hand in us getting a better Wheel of Meat choice this time around. And overall, I liked the story. I thought it was good. And for me, just the right amount of Loch Ness Monster. Not fucked up and weird like that Rick Springfield book that I hated. And I'm going to give it 4 stars.
Oh, Rick Springfield.
It does have a really good bourbon flavor to it, Livia.
I'm sure it does. So a couple Wheel of Meat notes. Yes, the best Wheel of Meat book we've read. Also, the first kind of, I don't know, literary, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I guess historical fiction is what this would fall into for a genre. But, I mean, fuck, the other one, like I said, was, you know, whatever you want to call it, maybe kind of horror. supernatural at least, and sci-fi. So this is the first straight one. It is nice to see how the other half lives sometimes, how, you know, people, because you have to imagine that there's a percentage of readers that only read stuff that they can buy from, you know, the end cap at Walmart or whatever, and that's typically your bestsellers, and that's it. So
yeah.
It's not a path we go down very often, which is why I like the concept of Wheel of Meat. I think that you and I, and probably the majority of our listeners, kind of fall into that category of we're in the minority. The books that we like, the books that we seek out, typically don't... they don't make it to Walmart, that's for sure. And well, but they're not New York Times bestsellers, so there's a much tighter-knit community that kind of rallies around some of the stuff that we enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the majority of readers, this is what they're reading, or it wouldn't be on the New York Times bestseller list.
That's true. Now, I did have a thought, and I really wish there's some way that this could come to reality. We read a book that, realistically, if you think about this, this is probably our first like legit book club book, like where we could have sat down with a gaggle of, you know, middle-aged women
and some old biddies.
Yeah, and had a fucking conversation about a book that they had read. And I've been imagining drunk Livius getting into arguments with these old ladies about this book. Like, no, fuck that. The Loch Ness Monster.
So, a future episode of book should be that I get drunk and we go to a book club meeting.
Tell me you don't see fucking tons of value in that idea.
Oh, it's fucking brilliant. I just, man, some old biddies are fierce. I'd get my ass kicked by some old ladies.
That's why we'll video it. We'll do, I'm off Meerkat, by the way. We're on to Periscope, which is the same thing, but made by Twitter.
Well, thank God for that.
So, we'll Periscope that. With Periscope, you're getting beaten down by a bunch of old ladies.
Yes, but I am bringing a taser because I ain't afraid of no old bitches. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, God. If you tase an old woman in an argument about this book, I don't think life could get any better.
Drunken book club. Oh, God.
He got drunk. In preparation for this book club discussion, Livius got drunk and brought a taser.
Oh, man. God damn it.
This is our best idea yet.
This is right up there with Pie Joe's.
Oh, nothing tops Pie Joe's. I can't tell you the level of disappointment I have in us not having met him. Because you know that guy is from Minneapolis.
I know, but that guy's not a big fan of ours. My understanding from the one Facebook post that he made.
He did call us dicks.
Yeah, well, we're dicks, to be fair. But we weren't specifically being dicks to him.
It was an accurate general assessment, but I think that he misinterpreted the situation.
Yes, yes. We thank you, Mr. Pie Joes.
Oh, shit. All right. There you go. At the water's edge. All right,
so speaking of drunken book clubs, we're only days away from the second Noir at the Bar Chicago, as put on by Jake Hinkson, who is kind and generous enough to allow us to kind of MC the event.
Yeah, so for whatever reason, we did a good enough job that he decided that we were going to be the host again. Happy about that. I think we're going to try and record it. Is that correct? Is that accurate?
I hope that's accurate, because that's our episode. That's our next episode. So if not, God damn it, we're going to have to read another Wheel of Meat selection.
Oh, God. I might become a book vegetarian. Yeah, I'm excited about that. Jake Hinkson, just fresh from France, so I'm going to try and talk to him in French as much as I could. But what's the lineup? Because I don't have it sitting in front of me.
It is Jedediah Ayers, who is no stranger to this particular podcast, Heath Lawrence, Libby Fisher-Hellman, and Dan O'Shea, who I'm very excited to see read. I think I might have mentioned this in the last episode, but he's going to wear that goddamn coat, isn't he?
You know he's going to wear that paisley... Like, it looks like he took a couch and cut it up and made a coat out of it.
So that's like a thing. Okay, so not to that goddamn...
Oh, I know where you're going.
Okay, Rob Hart.
I knew that's where you were going.
Just bought... I saw this on Facebook.
Like a purple velvet fucking blazer.
Yeah, with a pocket that's like a different color.
Or the leather-accented pocket, yeah.
Yep. For his readings, so... I now feel so underdressed whenever we're at a reading event. Maybe we'll have to dip in the Patreon funds and get me something a little more reading stylish.
Do I have to?
No, Rob. Okay, you've got the hat, dude. You do the hat thing.
I got the hat. That's good enough.
I've got nothing. I have no defining piece of wardrobe. He'll be like the guy who's in the black sweatshirt all the time.
It's true. You got to have a hat and glasses like me here.
Yeah. Wow. We tried that. That didn't work out very well.
So we're looking at, it is the 30th, which is, is it Thursday?
It is Thursday.
So Thursday, April 30th at Sylvie's Lounge. 7:00 p.m. is when the reading starts. We all know in the world of fucking people who understand how life really works that readings never start on time, but get there at 7 anyway, you know. Show up a little early, grab some drinks, get settled in and everything like that. We are hosting, we are recording, but don't let the fact that we're recording dissuade you from showing up, because seeing Jedediah Ayers read is awesome. And I'm really looking forward to Heath and Libby as well, because I haven't seen them read before, so it's always nice to kind of like, you know, add people to the repertoire and kind of meet new people. And Dan O'Shea, that man's got such a buttery voice. He's going to melt you. Ladies, he's going to melt you.
Here's what I'm going to say. Do you know what PS battles are?
Like Photoshop?
Yes. You know, yeah, what I'm talking about, right? Where people post a picture of someone and then other. So I'm going to, if he wears that jacket, I'm going to take a picture and I'm going to try to get this on Reddit or wherever, Imgur, wherever these things are done, and see if people PS battle with him in that coat.
I told you, I don't know if I ever showed you this, but I do something like that at work. Did I ever show you any of these?
I did see some of this. The screensaver on your iPad, right? The thing that you had scrolling on the TV in Minneapolis? I mean, that's kind of the idea. Yes, yeah. I saw them.
So,
yes.
At the place that I work, we have kind of a collective like photo thing that we all can get into of things that have happened at work. And it occurred to me that I could take those photos and just kind of humorously put people into historical situations. And so that's kind of my own, I guess, personal version of that, where I take pictures of like people from work and work environments and put them into like
Tiananmen Square.
Yeah, Tiananmen Square was one. I have someone sitting kind of at a desk behind Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, that kind of stuff. So it's kind of funny.
Yes, we should do this more.
Yeah. So I like your idea. Photoshop battle, Dan O'Shea in his coat.
Yep.
His majestic mustache.
And then, now, I don't believe we're actually part of this other reading that I want to mention, but I want to solidify, I want to on-air get Rob's commitment.
We haven't been invited yet.
Mark Z. Danielewski is going to be reading in Chicago, and I totally think we need to go.
My only concern is that the venue is not going to hold the number of people that want to attend. But absolutely, I don't see how we could miss that.
We need to get there early and drunk.
With a taser?
Maybe with a taser. You never know, that Danielewski guy might be fucking a little lippy.
He seems scrappy. Yeah. So I'm going to bring my two copies of House of Leaves and my one copy of Only Revolutions, I think, to get him to sign those.
I am going to buy stuff there, I think.
Whoa. Do you not own copies of Danielewski's stuff?
You know what? I have a copy of House of Leaves, but it is it's not in good shape. And if I'm going to have him sign one, I want it to be something I can put away that's in good condition. So, yeah.
I'm going to give him a Sharpie and my phone and see if he'll sign my copy of 50-Year Sword. See what he says.
There you go.
No.
Does that let's not do that. I don't know. Maybe we can use the like 35 seconds we'll have with him while he's signing your two copies of House of Leaves to see if we can get him on the podcast. How cool would that be?
Oh, and I'll record it so that he has no way to deny it?
Well, no. Well, here's the problem. If you record it, we play it. They'll be like, see, I was on your podcast. You played that recording.
Oh, shit. No. We only put that on if he never comes on the podcast.
Oh yeah, I guess that could work.
We got at least we have something.
There's that. We could offer him like $20. I mean, we've never paid for a guest before, but I'm willing to do it for Danielewski. I mean, I've got like $14 in change in my car. I'll bring that with me.
I got you covered. I have a $20 bill that I found next to my car the other day.
Wait a minute. Did it have a 20 in each corner on the front?
It was, I don't know what you mean. It was a regular $20 bill.
Okay, because I lost a $20 bill. Mine had 20 on it in the corners and had a picture of a president, one that's not alive anymore. Does this sound like it might be my $20 bill?
It might be yours.
All right, even if it's mine, what we'll do is we'll give that to Daniel Lewski, and I'll throw in whatever changes in my car that day. What other avenues do we have? I don't think we know anybody who's like on a personal basis with them, do we? Do we have anybody?
I think the closest we have is that Misty one time. Misty Bennett, friend of the podcast, one time after a Daniel Lewski reading was getting him to sign something or something like that, and she saw Stephen Graham Jones and totally ditched Daniel Lewski to hang out with Stephen Graham Jones, which is an excellent story. But it doesn't help us at all.
I was going to say, I don't see how that gets us. But, yeah, there is that. Yeah, if anybody knows Daniel Lewski, tell him that he can avoid all of the embarrassment of having us shower him with change or tase him. Or, I don't know, beg incoherently while I'm drunk by just reaching out and saying, guys, I'd love to do your podcast and I'd love to talk about The Familiar with you. And we promise we won't ask lots of questions about House of Leaves because that's what happens. You see these interviews, it's like that Robert Downey Jr. interview. He's on there to talk about the Avengers. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Oh, where I know there was some scandal, but I don't know the story behind it.
So here's what happened. Some guy who's done this before, apparently, gets Robert Downey Jr. It's a pretty good get, right, for an interview?
I would say.
And then starts asking him about his, like, drug addiction and alcoholism, like his relationship with, like, his absent father.
Why would you...
This shit was all...
Like, who didn't know about that from, like, 2 decades ago?
Well, that's the whole thing. Like, why would you bring that up now instead of, like, just being like, hey, it's cool, people will tune in and see this interview because, you know, I've got Robert Downey Jr. So Robert Downey Jr. kind of stormed off. He did it in a pretty classy way. I mean, he wasn't, like, a huge dick about it.
A classy storm?
Yeah, he was cool. He's cool. Everything he does is cool. That guy's just cool.
He's cool. I will agree with that. Yeah. But here's what we do. I figured out for Daniel Lewski.
Okay.
We were really close to figuring out the perfect formula, and I figured it out. You ready?
I am ready.
You have the taser in your hand. I'm standing next to you, and you say, unless you agree to be interviewed on our podcast, I will tase him. You threaten to tase me.
This is a win-win situation, I think.
And then he says yes, and then you tase me anyway.
That's, yeah, pretty, oops, sorry, I don't know how to use one of these.
Yeah.
And any formal training.
I think it's perfect.
So, but yeah, so we've got a couple of outings then in the next month or so. So definitely Noir at the Bar, stop out, as Rob said, get there early and say hello to the booked team. I will probably have Kevin Lynn Helmick in tow, so if you have anything you need signed by him, definitely bring that with you.
Ooh, I will have 3 copies of the booked anthology available if people want those.
I will, Rob, you want to know what I found recently?
What?
Remember the very first bookmarks?
Oh, you have some of those?
They're technically the second bookmarks. The first bookmarks were made that referenced Neil Smith's blog where we were mentioned. The second ones say, or the booked ones that say...
high quality audio. No,
high quality reviews, low quality audio. Yeah. I have some of those that I will bring to give away with copies of the booked anthology, and maybe we'll randomly stuff them in copies of other writers' books. So if you buy a book, you never know. You could get a endangered species bookmark, because I think there's only probably about 40 of them.
That's crazy, dude. I don't even have one of those. I do have stickers.
I'll give you one.
I've got booked stickers that will be free.
Yep, you can put them on your car, like Craig Clevenger,
like Pela Villa.
Oddly, I don't put stickers on my car. there are 0 booked stickers on my car.
I had a booked sticker on my car.
Did somebody steal it? Because those are pretty rare.
It got crowded out by all the Apple stickers.
Oh, my God.
No, there's only one. It's a joke. No, I wanted to put the other one on, and I just keep getting... It was like, oh, the car that's dirty where I put the sticker, and I didn't want to, like, fucking clean off it. Yeah, so... laziness. Little, like,
4-square-inch
spot. I was thwarted by laziness.
Like, spit on it and wipe it off at the sleeve of your Apple sweatshirt.
What are you talking about? So join us at Noir at the Bar, like Livia was saying. If you're going to be at the Daniel Lewski reading and you have a better alternative than us threatening either to tase him or each other to get him on the podcast, please let us know, because that probably will result in much fewer arrests. What else we got going on? So the next episode is going to be the reading, right?
Yep. So next episode, episodes maybe, I don't know. There's only four readers. Dude, did you see that lineup for, which one was it? I don't think it was Noir at the Bar Boston. It was like 18 people reading.
Oh, yeah. That was like L.A. or something, right?
What, no. I was just like, listen, I was reading the list of people and I was like, hey, I got to take a break from reading for a little bit. So I had to walk away from it for like 20 minutes and come back and finish the list of people.
It was, yeah. And I'm thinking, we went to two readings when we were in Minneapolis and, the first one only had like five readers, right? The Broken River one?
Yeah, it was planned to have seven, I think, but some people couldn't attend. So yeah, I think it was five ultimately.
I was ready to fucking just open a vein after like reader number three. And then,
see, it depends on the readers. You weren't, because reader number four was David James Keaton, so don't say that. That's not true.
That's true. Well, I was just hoping I would open the vein on reader three, and I would hope that I wouldn't die before Keaton was done.
Gotcha. Okay, that's fair. You need some planning. Planning. I got it.
Exactly. It was a specific, precise timing. But the Bizarro reading, there was like 10... there had to be at least 10 people performing in some way at that reading. We made it through two or three, I think.
Yeah.
They were like, we are fucking out of here.
People keep saying, like, oh, readings. I've seen some friends, oh, readings. There are too many readings. Nobody cares about readings. I like readings, and I like the community of going to readings. And if not, then it's just hanging out in a bar, and it doesn't sound near as cool when I tell my coworkers, like, listen, I got to leave early because I'm emceeing a reading. If I say I got to leave early because I'm going to the bar to hang out with some guys.
Yeah, and that's the thing about Noir at the Bar, that to kind of bring it back to something on topic, is that I haven't been to a Noir at the Bar, and the I love the fucking example. Livia's is probably tired of it. Of when Scott Phillips had to apologize for being the second person who had a story that had a woman getting punched in the stomach that was pregnant. Like, that's the kind of thing you're in for with Noir at the Bar. You never know. Like, crazy shit's going to happen, and it's going to be offensive, probably bloody, maybe sexy, but kind of in a weird way that you might be ashamed of after the fact. It's just much more entertaining than your typical stuffy literary reading would be, is what I'm trying to say.
They are always a good time.
Always, without fail. Jed Ayers is going to be there. He's like the stepfather of Noir
at the Bar. Stepfather. Oh, I've got some good stepfather jokes I heard somewhere.
Hit me.
I don't.
Oh, damn it. I was really excited to hear some stepfather. All right. I guess I'll have to live with that. It's fine. Oh, Dan O'Shea. I'm going to get him to sign my book.
Now okay, I'm just looking now at my bookshelf. Randomly, I gotta get the oil changed in my car. What's happening right now?
Shit, he already signed it. We're good with that.
Oh, I had another goddamn thought. We keep having these thoughts. They keep coming, no matter what. I don't remember. At any rate, Noir at the Bar this Thursday. Be there. Oh, he hasn't unfriended me, but I doubt he's gonna show up. I invited Andrew Vax to Noir at the Bar.
I was considering, I'm actually Facebook friends with Gillian Flynn. Mm-hmm. I was considering sending the invite.
Yeah. I invited Vax, who I'm a huge fan of his work. But God, the more I'm friends with him on Facebook, the more I think I just don't like him as a person. So
he is, he's the one that posts. He's very passionate about, child protection against like, abductions and that kind of thing. Right. Child abuse.
Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah, so that is a majority of what he posts online. But, I mean, it's a noble pursuit, and it's definitely Facebook is a forum to kind of get that message out there. But there's kind of be a little much sometimes. But Andrew Vax.
I was glad you did say he's really passionate about, like, child abuse. He's really passionate about, like, child pornography.
Oh, no.
Dude, that guy was on Oprah.
Vax was?
Back when Oprah was a thing. Yeah, a couple of times, I think.
Nice.
Yeah, so at any rate, maybe he'll be at Noir at the Bar. Who knows?
Are you going to bring an eye patch just in case? So you can be cool like Andrew Vax?
No, because then he'd just think I was mocking him. I'll wear one there and I'll wear one home, but not if he's there.
Well, if he gives you shit, you just tase him. I thought we were down with this.
I swear to God, we need to buy a taser.
Put our book sticker on there.
Yep.
All right. I think we've probably scraping the bottom of the barrel here, the bourbon barrel that we aged our beer in.
Yes, the bourbon barrel. Bourbon Flavored Beer Barrel. So, yeah, next up, one or maybe two episodes of Noir at the Bar. After that, who knows? Who knows? I know.
We would know if our calendar didn't get fucked up.
No. I actually know what it is, but we're still kind of reworking our schedule a little bit. So I think I know what it is.
That's as good. I'll take that.
Until then, I'm Livius Ned.
And I'm Rob Olson. Keep reading.